We're back. Welcome to Logic Gate, where we are discussing Star Wars TV show Andor on Disney Plus. As always, I'm your host, Scott, and I'm joined by my two friends, Doug.
Hello.
And Jason.
Hello.
Presented in alphabetical order. That is not the order of my friendship.
I mean, he did kind of copy me, though, a little bit, right? I said hello, and he was like, hello.
Yeah. Jason, you really got to be more original.
Come up with something new, man.
I copied your score last time, too, I guess. You have good taste.
Well, it'll be interesting to see this. This was quite the episode, I will say. I feel like things ramped up a little bit, but let's dive. Do we have any recap or any corrections from last week? Anything come up? I did not have anything written down in case you guys came up with anything.
I'm sure I could think of something to bicker about, but I think we should probably just forge ahead.
I mean, we did have some predictions about like who was going to be a traitor, but we can get to that.
Yeah, no, totally called it, but yeah, okay.
Doug. Okay, we'll get there, but yeah. Okay. Yeah, you did, for sure.
All right, so the episode opens at the top of the ridge, I guess, or just near the top of the ridge, and Nemec comes out and he tells Cassian that he can't sleep, that he's essentially too nervous. The day before the raid or the event. And this was kind of like a long drawn out scene. And I didn't fully understand it, I think, until I watched it the second time. I'm curious what you guys took away from this little pep talk. Essentially, Cassian tells him just to man up and, you got to go through with it. You won't be tired later. What did you guys take away from this like little opening scene?
I defer to Nuge. Have we officially said he's Nuge?
Well, you just did.
In this episode, okay.
Not in this episode, it was last episode, but yes.
All right, fair enough.
Okay, to catch the audience up, my name is Jason, but I'm also known as Nuge. Just to clear things up for those jumping in for some reason to episode 6. That's it. So this scene is like basically just establishing more relationship between Nemec and Cassian. I think it's important for the events during the heist, and it's very important for the very end, or almost the very end scene, I think. So we can get to that.
That's what I was thinking, too, is the first time I saw it, I'm like, this is just kind of a weird scene. Like, he's just giving this kid a pep talk, but I think at the end, it ties back. So we'll get to that at the end, but I was just curious if you guys took anything else away from this, because it kind of seemed like a fluff scene to me. I'm not entirely sure.
I don't want to dwell on the scene too much, but I can say actually I related to that scene on a personal level.
Because you have to like overtake a lot of garrisons and steal money, or?
When I was deployed, there were definitely nights before a mission that you don't sleep. And I've been in both of their positions, the sort of rookie, like going across the border for the first time. I didn't sleep. I was nervous. And then later on, by the end of my tour, I was the veteran. I slept okay, but I also knew that whatever rest you didn't get, it was fine. Adrenaline would get you through.
Interesting. I never thought about it from a military point of view. The second scene cuts to an Empire lieutenant. Colonel, general, I don't know. And they're inside of the garrison, and they are having kind of like a little, like an Empire coffee break / party. And they basically talk about what's happening in this area, that there is a native tribe or a native people that used to live in this area, and they like the eye, and it's kind of... And they basically talk about how terrible these people are and how backwards they are and how stupid they are. And this is the Empire talking about how they kicked the people out of this valley because they want to build this base there. And that just really screamed to me. This is what you guys were talking about earlier, is like, where's the Empire being evil? Like, I don't see them, like, I'm not angry at them. But after watching, like, just this one scene, like, you just see how much the Empire looks down its nose on everyone else. I got, like, total colonizer vibes here. What'd you guys think?
Yes, absolutely, colonizer. It's an obvious, gesture towards you know, the colonizers and like the indigenous people, and how like it's not really black and white typically. It's like they're coming in to basically take the resources, but it's sort of a slow, more methodical. Like he talks about like wearing them down, offering small conveniences, but no real choices for their existence. It's sort of this, you know, the banality of evil type thing. It's
essentially so gleeful about how they had found a way to beat down this civilization.
Right.
So this is, I think, and there are several other scenes in this episode that have similar vibes to this, but it's really, I think, just to let the audience know, like, how truly evil the Empire is. Like, they may not be out, like, literally killing everyone. You know, they're not out putting a gun to people's heads, but they are ruining lives. They are.
Yeah.
In fact, I think what he tells them was that there are these indigenous peoples named the Dani, and they essentially have a pilgrimage to come see the Eye every 3 years. And they were expecting, maybe because they have to make a trek from the bottom of this valley, like by on foot. And they were expecting maybe 60 people to make it to the top this year. Whereas in past years, the number had been 15,000. So mm-hmm. It was just more kind of poking at them, like, you know, we've kicked these people out so that we can build our fantastic star base here.
Yeah, this is a great way to this. So it didn't exactly tell me like, oh, here's some examples of them being evil. It sort of more directed my attention towards like the theme of this episode and maybe overall in that there's not really good guys and bad guys. It's more about like what you stand for, your like ideologies. It's sort of a broader, like, which side are you going to stand on? I mean, this whole episode reinforces that, so we'll get to it, I guess.
The next scene cuts to, and this is one of those really quick scenes, but it's important because it sets up the rest of the episode, is it cuts to Terramin, and he is trying to talk to Vel on this radio. They're trying to establish communication on this old technology, and he's having problems with it, and he's flipping the dials up and down. I think at one point he kind of smacks it. So they're really kind of beating home what Nemec said in the last episode, that they have old technology, but it's still good. It'll work, you know, after everything else is broken, this old tech will come through and it won't let you down. I mean, that was one of those like 30-second scenes, but I think they just want to reinforce that. And it does pay off a little bit later. So the next quick scene is the squad hiking towards the garrison, and there are four of them, I believe. It's Terramin, Clem, Skeen, and I forget who the other one is.
Is it Nemec? The mouse, yeah.
Yeah, it's Nemec, right. and anyway, they are hiking, and Terramin's in the lead, and he starts barking orders at them, and he says, pick it up. And then Skeen kind of leans over and tells Terramin, Skeen leans over and tells Clem that Terramin used to be a stormtrooper. And you really see it in his like militaristic like hiking and the way he barks orders at people. And there's a quick line where Skeen mentions that once everybody found out that he used to be a stormtrooper, like Cinta got really angry because stormtroopers killed her entire family. So that kind of messed up the dynamic of the group. But Terramin being a stormtrooper definitely comes into play later. It's a quick scene, but he just mentions that, hey, he used to be a stormtrooper.
So I found it kind of funny because like their whole marching practice where Clem was correcting him was like, oh, okay, that puts that in a different light.
Yeah, right. So just a quick scene on the hiking, or their marching, I suppose. And then the next scene gets cuts to the outside of the garrison. So we can actually see kind of where the squad is going to be attempting to break in. And right about this time, the Dani, the native tribe, has marched or hiked all the way to the top across a multi-day hike. There are, like I said earlier, probably about 50 or 60 of them. And they get to the top, and the Empire forms up ranks. Like they make the Dani, they're on a path, and they make the Dani march between six Empire guards holding guns. Like it was really kind of I felt like a way to, you know, embarrass isn't the right word, but just to let them know that, hey, we're here, we're watching, and you're really not welcome. It was an intimidation, I think. Did you guys get that impression?
I will be honest. The whole, all of the scenes with the Donnie marching up to their sacred spot, I was so distracted because it looked like the extras that they cast for that scene, they just went down to like the Santa Monica Pier and picked like random ass people. Sorry.
Really? You think so?
It was distracting. They don't look anything like, half of them are looking straight at the camera. Half of them are like grinning. Oh, like, wow. I'm an extra. It was distracting.
So at this point, the Donnie are at the top. And you see the very first meteor strike or whatever. You can tell that the eye is just getting ready to, you know, go off, right? And the meteor strike has a really cool sound. It almost sounds like a TIE fighter. It has a very distinct, like, meteor sound. So I just noted that not only does it look cool, but it sounds cool also. And then you see the squad of that we talked about earlier, of Skeen and Clem and Terramin and Nemec, and they fall in and they basically escort the Donnie up the very last, you know, maybe 100 yards. So now they're on escort duty. Did you guys follow? Because I didn't totally follow. Where were the original guards that were supposed to do the job that the squad was doing?
I think that they're staying down at the temple near the temple.
Because there was that other scene where Cinta and Vel were inside of that little, you know, yeah, like cave or whatever, looking out, and they had four guards there, and like they were waiting for them. I sort of got the impression like that they dispatched those guards, and then that's why the squad was able to take over, because, you know, there was an empty spot in the roster or whatever. I don't know. It all happened off screen, and even after I watched it twice, I couldn't tell exactly. So the point is that somehow a handful of Empire guys got waylaid, and that the squad is able to fill in and walk the Donnie the rest of the way up, which also gets them very close to the garrison.
Okay, I didn't notice that, but yeah, that makes sense.
There's
a little scene with them like hiding. You're talking about where they're hiding in this like rock, and the soldiers come up. They seem kind of startled or like, you know, frozen. And one of the soldiers pees.
Yes,
takes a little break there.
Yeah, and you never see what happens is they hide, and those guards were way down in the valley or whatever. So I inferred that those were the guards that perhaps the squad replaced, but I don't know. So let's go on a little bit more, and I think I might be able to explain what I was
there. Thinking. I did want to note, like, back behind a little bit, Vel and Cinta, in their separation, there was this quick scene of them underwater using, like, these, like, jet propulsion things, which was really cool. So I just...
Oh, yeah. Was that a jet propulsion thing, or was that, like, a little mini sub?
I thought it was, like, they're holding on to, like, a jet thing.
I think it was a jet-propelled mini sub.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you're both right.
it's like a Metal Gear Solid. It totally reminded me. Yeah. Anyway, the soldier peen. I think that might be a first for Star Wars, at least for me. Like a
scene
of pee.
First urination in a Star Wars.
Yeah, like blatantly, and there's like several firsts in this episode that I'll try to point out as we go. So anyway.
The next scene, we cut back to the Empire guys that were basically talking about and putting down the Donnie, and you learn that the main general guy's name is J-Hold, and he is now getting dressed and getting ready for a formal event, and he can't get his belt on, and he's there with his wife and his son, and he tells his wife to come over and help him, and she says, no, I'm helping the kid get dressed. And he was like, well, he's 12. He can dress himself. And then he says, basically, come over here and help me with my belt. And then the line that he has was great, because, I mean, clearly the guy's gained some weight. And he's complaining. He's like, he said, none of this was stored properly. It's all compressed. Like, you know, somehow his belt shrunk while it was in the whatever. And his wife just looks at him frustrated and goes, perhaps you've expanded.
Yeah, just like a really quiet dig. Like, you know, like she could barely get away with something like that. It wasn't like she was roasting him. It was more like she's kind of afraid to talk to him. But it was like a little tiny poke, you know?
Yeah, you can tell that their relationship is a little bit frosty because he was barking orders at the kid about making sure that he's on his best behavior for tonight. And
yeah,
the wife tries to give him an out, like, oh, the kid's sick. And they just kind of banter back and forth. So.
And so here is a scene where it's like not even necessary, given what happens in the show and to this character, but it just adds so much. And it's kind of a first to see sort of like a regular mid-level like empire dude that, and see that his family and like a little bit of his backstory and like what some context for his character. So just I appreciate that.
It also makes him less likable because you see him like bossing his wife and his kid around.
Well, yeah, I don't know about likable is different, but I do empathize with him more that now that I know more of his context.
Oh, interesting.
You know, not necessarily like him, but it's just nice to get more texture.
I think I liked him less. You know, it's one thing if you know you've got a clear enemy and you're angry at them, but here he is angry at his kid because his kid doesn't want to wear his dress uniform.
Oh yeah, he seems like a dick. Yeah.
Right.
What's his name?
J-Hold.
Mm-hmm. So, a couple of things that I noticed with this scene, but with also just him in general, and I'm curious if I'm just not thinking accurately here. Do Imperial officers usually have beards? I don't know that I've seen an Imperial officer with a beard. In military standards, that's a little sloppy. Like, you don't generally wear a beard. You're clean shaven. Mustache is okay. Yeah, yeah. But so that, plus the fact that he's overweight, clearly, which they make it a point to tell us because his belt doesn't fit or whatever.
Because of the compression.
Yeah. He's kind of a jerk to his family, and he's kind of sloppy. He's not a great Imperial officer.
Well, perhaps that's why that's why he's stationed where he is, because they've definitely gone out of their way to say that getting the post on this base is one of the least desired posts. So maybe he ticked somebody off and he got sent there.
I also think this scene, and forgive me, I know I'm spoiling, but I can't not mention it. I think this scene is one of the precursors to help it make it believable that he has a heart attack later in the episode.
Is that what happens? Okay, well, let's discuss that, because I was not entirely clear on that. So the next thing you see is Vel basically sprints across the top of the garrison after she plants some sort of... you don't know at this point. It looks to be some sort of bomb, but it ends up being a communication scrambling device next to the guard tower or whatever on top of the garrison. And then she sprints across to meet up with Cinta. So there, she catches up to Cinta, and they're kind of like crouched behind this, you know, between these boxes, trying to stay low. And you hear Terramin on the radio, and he's calling over and over because she's a little bit late getting to her position, and she doesn't respond immediately. And you can tell, like, she's got some fear in her eyes, or she's definitely nervous. And Cinta looks at her and was like, you have to respond. And there's like this tension of like, is Vel going to crack, and is she not going to respond? But she does respond. She lets Terramin know that they're on the radio. And then she has to give the Terramin says, are we go? I need a go order. I need to hear you say it before, you know, I go start my part. And she hesitates again on the go order. She really doesn't want to. She's not raring to go, I should say. And the first time I watched it, I was like, okay, well, she just can't handle the pressure. There's a lot going on here. But ultimately, she does give the go order. But the second time I watched it, if you look at the what she does immediately after she gives the go order is jumps over the edge of that dam or whatever that is, and then just goes straight down on that rope, like a solid 50, 60, 70 feet. And like, I don't care like how gung-ho you are, like that would be gnarly. So I almost took it like she was more nervous to have to do her part, because this next jump that she had to do was pretty crazy. But clearly, I think she was having problems with the go order as well.
Well, I took it differently. I mean, she does kind of look down like from the height, and you get that POV of how high it is. But I also took it as her knowing what's going to happen when she starts, when she, you know, goes
right
past the point of no return, because what happens to Cinta and what happens just in general, you know, she kind of knows, like, you know, this is a point of no return. So
right.
Also, she's a terrible leader.
She there's definitely some hesitation on her part here, and I will give you that, but I think she redeems herself later, and I want to talk about that as well. We're getting closer.
All right, disagree, but she's completely irredeemable. I hate her.
All right, fair enough. The next scene cuts back, and again, we're cutting back and forth between, you know, the different parts of the squad and then the Empire, as clearly the eye is approaching and the sun is setting. And so you see that the leader of the Dani, the native tribe, has reached the very, very top, and they're having essentially a formal, like, gift-giving ceremony with the general or whatever, with J-Hold. And they exchange goat furs. You know, it's some sort of traditional ceremonial thing. They exchange goat furs. And the Dani speak a native language. Donian? I don't even know. It's not important. And he says something to J-Hold in Donian, and the subtitles say, and the quote is, "Tell him our ghosts have strong hands and long memories," which I thought was just a badass quote.
He says, "May the eye find the good in all of us."
Indeed.
So he basically looks at, you know, J-Hold in the eyes and says this quote, but J-Hold doesn't understand Donian, so Gorn is there, and Gorn translates it incorrectly and says something about, you know, "I hope you have a long life," or whatever. Like, he's totally keeping things on the down low for J-Hold. I just thought that was a great line. "Tell him our ghosts have strong hands and long memories." And then the Donian leader takes the goat hide after everybody has left, and he walks over to a fire and throws it angrily in the fire. So there's no love lost between the Dani tribe and the Empire. Clearly they know that the Empire has been screwing them over out of their land and whatnot.
Yeah, another really, like, emblematic or reference to, like, indigenous relationships with colonizers. Like,
right.
There's these ceremonies, and like, if this was a situation which was important enough to the Empire, I kind of imagine, like, if this was for some reason this was taught in, like, schools, this history, they would portray it as, oh, we got along with these people and they helped us out, and, you know, it was a mutual benefit, you know. That would [S2] Right. [S1] Be the history taught about it, type of thing. That's what you know, it's kind of dark. Like, it's not [S2] Yeah. [S1] It's not super hitting you over the head with it, but the point of view that it gives is really interesting.
Well, I think at one point J-Hold even makes mention that they smell, or maybe he's talking about the goat fur. He was like, "I can't wait to get out of there because of the smell." You know, just like every little thing he can do to, like, belittle these people.
Right.
So it's a good job. It's good storytelling. It's good writing. You know, you really come to hate J-Hold and the whole Empire just because, you know, they're just being horrible people to these Dani for no reason.
Yeah. And Vel, you really come to hate Vel too.
Oh, do you? We must not have got to that part yet. So at this point, they're all at the top. So the squad is made at the top. The Dani is at the top. Gorn is out, and he tells all the soldiers that are not in the garrison to basically, you know, settle in for the night. You need to guard these Dani people going to be in here and enjoy watching the eye. And then they go inside, and the squad ambushes the Empire. So you see, once they get inside with J-Hold, because they're in Empire uniforms, they flip things around, and instead of escorting J-Hold, they end up ambushing him and taking him essentially hostage. Now, there was a little bit of question, because ultimately there's a Mexican standoff, because you see one of the Empire guards pointing a gun at Nemec, and they're all pointing guns at each other, and he tells them to let J-Hold's kid go. And so there was a little bit of a gray area, at least that I saw online, about who somebody fires and kills the Empire guy that was threatening Nemec and the Mexican standoff. But who was it that fired that shot? Was it clear to you?
Yeah, it was Cinta.
I thought it was Senta.
I thought it was Senta too, because she comes out of nowhere off of this ladder. But the second time I watched it, because what's happened is that Cassian is right behind this guy and has his gun out and pointed at him. And so there was a question on Reddit of, was it Cassian or Senta that shot them? And watching it the second time, I really think it could go either way. It's not clear. And neither one of them goes like, yeah, I got him or anything like that, you know? So yeah. I don't know if that's important. My first watching, it sure looked like Senta just came in and executed him right off of the ladder.
Don't take that away from me. Senta's a badass. Like, she... Her character is obviously like the gruff, like Clint Eastwood type. Like, it's, and it's awesome. And I want to believe that she's the one that came in and was the badass. But this whole scene, I have a lot more to talk about, but you guys can jump in for a sec.
I just want to point out, one, I thought it was weird that Cassian didn't shoot him right away.
Yeah.
I mean, you go back to episode one, he's not opposed to doing what he has to do. He obviously doesn't have a bloodlust, but that's a pretty quick situation. Just take measure of it. The solution is kill that guy. And Cassian didn't pull the trigger? That was a little weird.
The only thing that makes me hesitate is, especially later in the episode, because Cassian just straight up again shoots first and murders some guy, no questions asked. In the middle of a sentence. So that's the only thing that makes me think that maybe Cassian did it. And I want to watch that scene again, because it does. I mean, it goes towards Cassian's character. Is he just going to, you know, straight up execute somebody, you know, without due process or whatever? Clearly, we've seen him do it several other times.
I do still agree with Nuge, though. Don't take it away from me. This was one of Senta's badass scenes. And I love how she just drops down, like, stone cold look on her face, surveys the room like, anybody next?
Yeah.
And then Vel drops down right behind her and is like, I'm tough too. Pay attention to me, because I'm a big tough leader. Except she's not.
Yeah. Yeah. So the guy that was pointing the gun at Nimic is the Colonel Pedigar. Yep. He's like the higher ranking guy, I guess, that everyone was kind of trying to show off to. And
was he higher ranking than J-Hold?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Move.
This is an outrage.
Why? Stop talking.
Stop right there. Let the boy go.
Let the boy go!
J-Hold. Colonel, please.
Nobody has to die.
So this is, I mean, this is something you don't see in Star Wars, right? You see this in pretty good, like, I don't know, like insurgent type stories or war stories where you have kind of the good guys doing something really bad, holding this family hostage. I mean, this is ugly rebellion. And then you have the leader there, the highest ranking Imperial officer, doing something altruistic. And so this kind of brings back to my point about, like, there's not really heroes and villains. The characters themselves are all fairly well-rounded people, but it's what they stand for, and it's about the broader ideologies and overall meaning of what's happening, right? So it's just such a better, more refreshing, realistic look at the Star War, you know?
You're saying just because the characters are more three-dimensional?
The characters are realistic, and the rebels are portrayed in a very real, ugly way.
Right.
Which you don't typically see, right? They're like heroes, they're all put together. Oh, they're just going gung-ho, right? But this group of rebels is messy.
Yeah, messy is a good word to describe them. But to be fair, one, they're not an organized rebellion at this point. They all have, and I think this episode and the last episode really showcases it, they all have their own motivations, their own emotions and reasoning for doing what they're doing. And that really comes out in how they act in these situations. I do agree with you. I think it's kind of interesting to see the Star Wars universe portray this in more gray areas instead of just the straight black and white good guys versus bad guys.
Yeah, like I think it was Last Jedi that kind of like did that a little bit, but really didn't lean into it at all. Like it talked about, oh, these weapons are for the rebels. No, I sell these military weapons to both the rebels and the Empire, right? And that was supposedly some like revelation. Mm-hmm. And so it was just like, yeah, kid stuff compared to what's going on here. So I'm impressed. I like it.
Traditional Star Wars is very black and white. I mean, the Stormtroopers and Vader are clearly the bad guys, and Luke is clearly... There's no gray area in the original, really.
Yeah. So yeah.
Well, let's kick back to this particular scene. So everybody, their ambush has taken place. Gorn actually stays at the top outside of the garrison to keep the soldiers and sort of the Donnie in place so nobody sneaks up in on the plan as of yet. So it's worth noting that Gorn is outside at this point. So now that the Mexican standoff is in, the guy is dead, and Jay, their you know, boss and J-Hold around, Vel starts shouting orders at J-Hold, and I think this, I actually really liked Vel's character here because she sort of snaps out of it and shows a little bit of her badass side where she gets in J-Hold's face and starts making some threats and starts being a better leader to me. But clearly that didn't resonate with you, Doug.
She's very good at pretending to be tough.
Oh, I see. I thought this was a cool scene for her character. So the next thing you see is the scrambler that Vel had planted early on that guard tower kicks on. I don't know if they do it remotely or it was time-based, but scrambler kicks on and now all the comms are down. And you see a couple of the guards like out a little bit and they're like, oh, well, it must be the eye, you know? So then you start to see like how good of a plan this potentially was. Doing this in the middle of the eye has the added benefit of, you know, oh, it's going to knock out comms, or at one point maybe it knocks out the power. So you got a little more cover here. So they take J-Hold, you know, they're pushing him around and they're going to go down to the vault where the money is stored. It's worth noting here that Cinta stays with J-Hold's family. So, you know, a couple of his guards and his wife and son are in this, you know, control room, and they are now bound and gagged. And Cinta stays with them, and everybody else goes down to the vault, I guess. Now, there's a really cool scene here, and I thought this was a cool piece of misdirection, was they basically throw J-Hold against the wall, and they're like, let's go down to the vault. And he says, what are you doing? You know, you can't get into the vault. And Vel tells him like, oh, you know, all we need is your hand, because it's, you know, a hand scanner or whatever. And, you know, she says, you can go with us or I can take just the hand. And he doesn't flinch. He's like, yeah, okay, I don't know about that. Like, I don't control the vault. He says the vault is controlled by, you know, a base somewhere else or mission control. He was like, I can get you down there, but I don't have access to get into the vault. And so like, here is where they give you like this first red herring of, hey, maybe the mission's going to go awry. Maybe there's some information that they didn't have. They get all the way in here and they can't get into the vault, but they don't listen to them. So they go down to the vault and they essentially, I'm skipping ahead here. So they head down inside of the garrison to where the vault is. There's a bunch of Empire guards who are just sitting around playing cards because it's, you know, essentially the night of the eye and nothing's going on. And I did note that at this point, we're probably 5 minutes into this raid and there's no violence at all yet other than the Mexican standoff guy getting killed.
I mean, only one murder. That's
only one murder. So she was trying to motivate J-Hold. You know, and I mean, I was rooting for her because, I mean, they're, you know, the good guys in this situation and J-Hold's terrible. And I really kind of wanted one of them to like walk over to his wife and, you know, near in the gut or something like, look, if you don't do what we're going to say, we're going to hurt your family, because they played nice guy really well. And, you know, she basically says to him, don't make me hurt your family, but I'm willing to. So I think it's worth noting there's no violence here yet other than the murder. But I thought that would have been something that they could have done, was use some violence as a motivation for these Empire people.
Well, I mean, they kill the colonel. I mean, that's I think a pretty good show of
yeah
force. And J-Hold says, oh, you're just going to kill us anyway. And Vel says, oh, that's what you would do, isn't it? No, we'll let you go if you do what we say. I think it's set up really well. I think the threat is fair, and it's just a good scene. Yeah.
So the next thing that happens, so these guards are playing cards, and they all walk in, and Terramin immediately starts barking orders at them. And maybe, Doug, you can talk to this because you're in the military. I mean, he basically says, you know, what does he say? He says, muster, everybody line up. And he gets these guards that are playing cards to think like, you know, he's some sort of high up, and they listen. They stop what they're doing and they line up, and then they pull all their guns on them, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was a cool piece. So I think that explains the scene earlier where they're like, yeah, he was a stormtrooper, because you have to, you know, that's not a skill you would have or if you didn't have that experience in the past. So he makes use of his stormtrooper-ness in that scene by using it to distract the guards and before they have a chance to get their weapons out.
Yeah. That actually, in training and stuff, that kind of became an overplayed joke. Was if you were around a group of your buddies or something, you just yell at ease and watch everyone like jump up real quick and stand. And then, of course, they find out that you were just messing with them, and then they beat the shit out of you like after.
That would totally have worked in the military.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, it works. It's annoying. But it's like a reflex, really. Yeah. You just hear that tone, and you're like, okay, time to do thing.
Yep. So the next thing, they've got the guards distracted, and now they basically drag J-Hold over to the hand scanner to get into the vault. So remember, the vault is, I mean, you can see through it, you get the chain link and or whatever. Essentially, you can see the gold behind it. So at this point, you don't know if J-Hold was serious about, you know, it requiring more information from the mothership to unlock, but they throw his hand on, and sure enough, the gate opens. So J-Hold is just, he was just bluffing this whole time. But it certainly raised the tension for me, because I really thought like they were going to scan it, you know, it was going to come back, beep red, and say, you know, no authorization from, you know, whoever. But it doesn't happen. The door opens. So then J-Hold throws another thing at him where he was like, hey, you'll never be able to unlock the belt, because all this gold is essentially like ratchet strapped down to, I don't know, these pallets, I guess. And he was like, I don't have control of that. You'll never get that open without damaging the money. And that to me felt like another one of those like, oh, well, maybe this is going to be the thing that they didn't think of in the plan, was that they get all the way to the money and there are these straps that they, you know, and if they blow it up, it's going to blow the money everywhere. But so J-Hold's barking orders at him, telling him, you know, I don't have control to open those, blah, blah, blah. And then, but Nemec already has a plan. He's got some computer program or whatever, and they blow all the straps holding the money down, and now the money is loose.
Yeah, this is where the heist looks good. This looks like they're like competent. It's running smoothly. I mean, you know, yeah, J-Hold's like kind of yelling at them and saying it's not going to work, but they are like clockwork, and they're just
well
running.
Yeah.
So this is the Ocean's 11 midpoint in the heist where things are going
for
well.
Sure. So at this point, I'm trying to remember who is it. Is it Nemec is radioing Cinta? There's somebody on the radio of the squad. They're letting each other know that they have made it inside the garrison. All the other comms on the base are now down because they're blocking them. But there is there's a comm room, like it cuts to a guy who's surrounded by a bunch of equipment. And he actually hears the radio message of, I think, Nemec talking to Cinta. So at this point, there's somebody in the Empire realizes that something is going on. So the tension ratchets up again, because now he has the potential to alert other people.
That was the private that was on the rooftop watch when Gorn was talking to him about like tearing down the landscape and you know, commenting on the smell and stuff. So
yeah. So at this point, I what we can assume is that comms guard raises some sort of alarm, because there are guards there's a group of guards that were outside that presumably were guarding the Donnie. It's not entirely clear what they were doing. Maybe they're just watching the eye, but they were not inside because all the guards were out. They get an alarm and they essentially come running in. You see them running atop the cross of the garrison, and one of them is complaining like, what are we doing? Why are we, you know, we're going to miss the eye. And he's like, basically, get your butt in here. There's an alarm going off. right about now, the eye starts up for real. So you start seeing like this major, massive meteor shower. There's a cool pan up scene, and you know the CG gets played for all it's worth. And the Dani are now chanting, you know, very native people's style and enjoying this big event. And then it cuts.
It looks
back.
Awesome, by the way. We should comment does,
for
yeah,
sure.
Let's pause there and just acknowledge the fact that was just an awesome visual.
It was not at all what I expected it was going to be.
No,
guess,
but it was.
I guess I don't know what I expected it to be, but I do know that what they showed, that was not what I was anticipating.
But it seemed perfect, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that seemed like a plausible phenomenon. Like, it looked cool. It seemed like it would have some basis in physics and science.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I want to credit like this show. All the scenes look super good, super grounded. Mm-hmm. You kind of know where things are. Everything looks real. And this seems like this is really where they blew their CG budget. But it really stands out as something, you know, that we haven't seen anything like it so far. So it stands out. It's really impressive.
So the next thing, it cuts back inside the garrison and Gorn is now inside. And J-Hold realizes that Gorn has betrayed him or betrayed the Empire and kind of loses it. Just is very like bummed out because Gorn comes in and starts basically barking orders like, this ship hasn't left yet. Get this money loaded. So in the meantime, the squad has overpowered the Empire, and they're actually making the Empire guys load up all this gold onto the freighter that Clem is going to fly out of there. So you see they're getting as much money as they can on this freighter so they can get the heck out of Dodge before anything happens. They keep talking about a clock. They've got a clock going of, you know, how long it takes for the response because they had timed the TIE fighters earlier. Right about here, it cuts to a scene. You see some guards getting in TIE fighters. And you see the eye in the background behind the TIE fighters as the guys get in the cockpit. And that's a cool looking scene. And seeing the TIE fighters hanging there is super cool looking.
It's super cool looking. Yeah.
I was there. And that was one of the comments on Reddit too, was like, somebody posted a screenshot of that and it said, make this your wallpaper. And it's just like a TIE fighter hanging in front of this cool CG effect of the eye.
So I know we haven't really addressed it specifically just because of the sort of running cuts that they did. But what did you guys think of how they kept cutting back to like the chanting and the ceremony and then back to the action and then back to the, you know, the indigenous people of Southern California? I mean,
I thought I liked it because I mean, the Donnie are having like a full on, I mean, I can only compare it to like a Native American like sort of chant or, you know, party or whatever. So I think it builds tension because like you don't know what's going to happen. Is, you know, is J-Hold going to flip on them? Are the guards going to make it in there? Is the TIE fighters going to show up? And then like all of a sudden it cuts back to the Donnie and you get like, you know, who are just dancing around this fire. You get like a 15 second, you know, like chance to breathe, and then it cuts back and then you're right back in the tension. So the way they cut a couple times, I think it was just to draw out the scene a little bit. And I really liked it, actually.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of leaning a little towards Doug. Like, it really didn't do a lot for me. It does build the tension. It has some interesting, like, visual to cut to it. And the cuts get quicker as things get more intense, which is cool. But I think you're right, Doug. Like, they're character budget, their actor budget might be kind of strained here. Like, they keep making excuses for how little Adani is gonna actually show up, and they're like, they, you know, they're not maybe not the best you know, extras ever made, but I didn't catch them looking at the camera, but I guess it wouldn't surprise me.
Sting agency kind of phoned it in that day, it felt like.
So we're back in the garrison. They've got most of the money loaded, and right about now the guards from outside have made it into the garrison and they realize something is up because the vault is open. And I thought Gorn was, I assume that was him improvising. I don't know if that was part of the plan, but he basically tells the guard that you're not allowed to be in here. I order you to get out of here. This is a top secret operation and you do not have clearance for that. And like the guard doesn't know what to do. I mean, cause clearly something's up, but he's getting orders from, I mean, Gorn's been positioned on the space for 7 years, so clearly he has, you know, seniority. And at one point, he looks over at J-Hold, and he tells J-Hold, he's like, you tell him. Tell him he's not allowed to be here. And then the next thing that happens is J-Hold basically has a heart attack, right? Or
I think that's what I got.
I wasn't sure, because he kind of clutches his chest, but, you know, I wasn't sure, did he get shot in the back? Or he was just standing there, you know, watching all this stuff going on. Oh, he's helping him load the money, and he's clearly a out-of-shape fat guy, and he was struggling to help him load this money. And next thing you know, he basically collapses, and that's when the gunfight erupts between the squad and these Empire guys that have come.
Yeah, this is a really I really like this, when they come in, and it's like, Gorn's like, hey, you shouldn't be in here, and it's really tense to me. Yeah. To me, it worked really well. I got like a little Inglorious Bastard vibe.
The thing I liked about the scene was it was not cliche. It was not predictable. Like, I didn't know what was going to happen. There were, like I said, the thing with the hand where he was like, well, it's not just my hand. There were so many outs that there was at no point was like, okay, I know how the scene is going to end. Everything's going to be happy. And, you know, this guy's going to get killed and then they're going to get away. Like, it was all very much up in the air the whole time, which I thought was a really good piece of storytelling.
Reflected on something during this scene, because I kind of had a similar thought process. They showed Cassian, and the thought kind of hit me in that moment, like, well, we know he's going to be fine. I mean, he goes on to be in Rogue One, so I know he's getting out of this. And then I thought, but I can't say the same for anybody else in this scene. Literally anybody else on the team would be dead.
So let's talk about that. So the next thing that happens is Vel gets pinned down behind this, you know, box or whatever, and she's getting shot at from three different directions, and she yells at Terramin, you know, hey, I'm pinned down out here, and he kind of sighs, and he's like, okay, and he goes out, you know, basically to draw their fire so that Vel can get away, and Skeen is on the other side. So Terramin goes out basically to help Vel, get shot, and goes down, and but it distracts them just enough that Vel can get away. So it's not entirely...
Great leader, sacrificing her team to save her own life.
I don't think she sacrificed anybody. That was his
choice. She did it maliciously. It was part of her plan all along.
One can only assume Terramin is dead. He is down and not moving, but it is not, you know, they don't say what happens to him. They leave him behind. So about this point, everybody's on the barge. They've got a bunch of as much money as they can get on the freighter, and the freighter gets launched. You know, Cassian Clem kicks it into high gear and launches out of the way. But as part of the process, as part of the launch process, because there was so much thrust and the gold or whatever not being tied down in the ship, actually when they launch, actually pins Nemec to the wall, or kind of crunches against him. So he is clearly in a world of hurt. So it's what, Clem and Vel and Skeen and Nemec on the ship? Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Nemec gets crunched, and they're thinking he's going to die, or he's in a world of hurt. But they full-on Pulp Fiction adrenaline to the heart, essentially give him an emergency shot so that he doesn't pass out.
Yeah, and this was gnarly. They Pulp Fictioned him to just keep him alive long enough so he could like provide the navigation.
Yeah, I wasn't so sure like why they're working so hard. But yeah, so the next thing that happens is you find out that Nemec actually needs to do the navigation. He needs to provide the coordinates and tell Cassian how to fly, because Cassian mentioned several times, he was like, I need coordinates, I need a heading, I don't know where I'm going, I'm just a pilot. So
this was like one of the many times I kind of like went back and forth. I was kind of like, oh yeah, Nemec is definitely going to die here. Like in the first scene where the colonel is pointing the gun at him, okay, this is where Nemec goes down. Oh wait, I guess not. Now he gets crushed by money.
Yeah.
And okay, so this is it. Yeah, there he goes. Oh no, they got some med stick thing. Mm-hmm. It's going to keep him going. And it goes on and on.
So basically, Cassian is flying towards the eye, you know, blindly. He doesn't know where to go. He doesn't have an exact heading. So you see the TIE fighters are now chasing them. The TIE fighters have caught up to them, and they are flying in, you know, sort of the upper atmosphere. Cassian's flying towards the eye. At one point, the TIE fighters are super close to getting a lock on the ship, but the lock ultimately fails. You see kind of like the TIE fighter computer scramble because the eye is interfering with their targeting computers. So at this point, Nemec is high out of his mind because he's got this adrenaline shot or whatever to the heart. He's able to run his iPad just enough to tell Cassian to climb. He says, climb now. And Cassian's looking at, he says, are you sure? Like, he's looking up, like, there's, you know, meteors, like, right there. And he was like, no, you have to climb right now. Then he tells him to dive. He's basically, Cassian would definitely not have done that maneuver without Nemec, because if he did not have that direction, he was clearly not comfortable doing those maneuvers. But Nemec saves the day. They basically make it out of the eye. I mean, it is legitimately, you know, like the eye of a needle. They kind of thread it at the very last minute and they make it out into space. The TIE fighters do not, actually the TIE fighters, I don't know if there was two or three or however many were chasing them, but they were actually destroyed by the meteors in the eye. And at this point, it was actually, I was feeling pretty good. I mean, they made it out of this heist relatively cleanly. You know, I really thought that they would.
They got
a lot of money. The Empire, they were, you know, free and clear at this point, other than Nemec being a little hurt and Terramin being down. But
so you're just going to gloss over that scene like it was just another scene. Like, that might have been the coolest. Them escaping through that meteor shower, like this crystal,
the sound looking
shiny.
Cool.
These crystals crashing towards them, and the TIE fighters like barely scraping by, and then getting blown up. I mean, this was maybe one of the coolest things in Star Wars that I've ever seen. Like,
it's really hard to describe. I mean, clearly everybody listening to this should have watched the episode, so I don't need to describe it. But yeah, you're right. It was a great piece of CG. Yeah, the way you see the TIE fighter cockpits, like the glass shatter as they hit some of the pieces from the meteors, and yeah, it was extremely well done. They blew their budget on the CG on this episode, and it was well worth it.
Looked absolutely amazing, and I'm with Nuge. This might have been one of the best scenes in Star Wars ever. Right. And it was kind of ruined a little bit by the... I kept getting frustrated because they'd show the shot inside the cockpit, and Cassian's flying all intense, and the others are holding on to the back of the chair, and Vel is holding on to the back of the empty chair with the seatbelt strapped right across the front. Like, why don't you just sit down, strap in? It's a good idea. Look what happened to Nemec. I mean, might be a good idea to put your damn seatbelt on.
So at this point, it's clear that they are safe, but Nemec is basically passed out and in a lot of pain. So there's a quick scene where Vel doesn't necessarily want to divert course, but they have a doctor built into the contingency plan if someone gets hurt. And Skeen, you know, talks Cassian in, like, we need to take this kid to the doctor. The options are, we can take this kid to the doctor, or we can just, you know, take off with the money and let Nemec die. And Clem, or Skeen says, we would not be here. Like, this kid pulled this whole mission off. We would all be dead if it wasn't for this kid. And so,
Cassian, was it Skeen that made that decision?
It wasn't. No, it was. No, it was.
It was like a vote, I guess. Two against one.
He says, we need to get this kid to the doctor. And Cassian just sits in the pilot seat and says, all right, how do we get to the doctor?
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yet another example of Vel's strong leadership.
Has anybody looked at IMDb? Does Vel make any appearances after these episodes? Are we done with her so I can listen to? I don't have to listen to Doug complain about her?
I have no idea, but I have no idea what to expect with this show.
Yeah, especially after this, I have no idea what the next.
We can argue about Vel later at the end, but.
All right, so the next thing, they need decide to take Nemec to the doctor. So they end up on some planet. It's not clear where. There's a four-handed doctor with orange skin. He's clearly the same race as Maz Kanata, which I don't know what that race is. And Maz Kanata only had two arms, but clearly they are related in some way. So while the doctor is inside, essentially operating on Nemec, I thought it was really dark because Vel actually has to hold like the blood bags up, you know, and the IV bags. Like, he didn't have one of those poles. Like, he basically made Vel stand there and hold the blood bag and watch him do surgery, and she's just standing there like horrified.
That was awesome. I mean, like,
it was great. Yeah. So Skeen and Clem are outside, and Skeen basically says, "Do you know how much money we got?" He says, "We got $80 million credits." And he basically offers him, he says, "Hey, you and me are the same. How about I take $40 million, you take $40 million. I can't pilot that freighter out of here. You don't have any place to go. I've got a planet we can hide on. Why don't we split this money and screw everybody else?" And Cassian's kind of blown away. He's like, "Whoa, really? I thought you were really invested in this Rebel Alliance. Like, what's going on? Like, what about?" And he asks him, he says, "What about your brother with the orchard?" And Clem says, "I made him up. He's not, you know," he was like, "that was all just BS. He was like, I'm here just like you are. I'm just here for the money." He's like, "Now I have a chance at $40 million. And he's literally in the middle of a sentence, and Cassian stands up and just shoots him straight in the gut, just execute style. And so the notes I took was Clem shoots first. Like, he was not having it. So this is at least the second, maybe the third guy we've basically seen Cassian just straight up murder execution style. So I thought it was cool. It was good for his character because, you know, I was like, finally, like, he's standing up for the good guys because Skeen was going to screw everybody over.
Yeah, it may be more that he's just not sure. Well, he's not really sure what to do in this situation. It's sort of like a quick reflex to just, when in doubt, kill. Or more like he doesn't know if he can trust Scheme. I don't think he's completely bought into do what's right. Right? He's more just like, "Oh crap, this Scheme guy is like a psychopath. He lied about the whole brother story."
Yeah.
He doesn't know what to do because he knows if he lets this whole thing play out any longer, it's going to get ugly. So he's just kind of.
Strongly disagree with you. To say he doesn't know what to do is not giving him credit. He knows exactly what to do because Skeen's basically put him in this situation, forcing him to have to do this. Because what are his options? He says no to Skeen. Now he has to constantly look over his shoulder, you know, sleep with one eye open because he knows this dude will betray everybody, himself included. And Skeen might just do the math and think, now that I told him that, I have to kill him if he doesn't go along with me. This is a self-defense thing. Cassian's done the math. He knows there's no way at all past this point that he can trust Skeen. Even if he goes along with it and says, "Okay, yeah, let's take off and split the money," he knows that Skeen's just going to shoot him. Like, but there's no way you can trust him. He does the math. He realizes, nope, the only way that I can get out of this is by killing Skeen. And he does.
I like to imagine in my head he did it for some altruistic reasons, but I'm sure that was part of it also. So
you're right, Doug. He did do the math. Like, yeah, and that's what I mean. If he let this whole thing play out any longer, it would have gone downhill really quickly. And so he did do quick thinking, and I think it puts him in the situation of not necessarily doing. Like what's right, but forcing him to take a side in a sense. Like he could have taken Scheme up on his offer and, like, you know, just watched his back. And so, but it was a really kind of, it wasn't a very attractive offer. So he, it just kind of forks the road a bit for him and his character, I think.
Well,
we'll say what he does after that, though, as far as going in with that was the good.
What
thing
does he do after
do,
that?
He walks inside and he pulls a gun on Vel and he's like, "Hey, I'm leaving the ship. I'm taking my money. Return this crystal to the guy that brought me to
you." He takes his cut of the money. He doesn't take, you know, $10 million or anything. He takes whatever his cut was and he basically tries to buys the doctor's ship so that he has, you know, some sort of transportation out of there. But he leaves the freighter and the score. I mean, he leaves whatever, $80 million minus his cut. With Vel, Nemec is dead at this point, so I'm not really sure how Vel is going to get off this planet because she can't fly a ship, I don't think, but who knows. So as he's walking out, you know, he says, I'm going to go my own way, you can keep the money, Vel says, oh, hey, one more thing. And she says, Nemec wanted me to give this to you. And she hands Clem Nemec's manifesto. And I thought that was really weird until I watched it the second time. So I think this is really a tie back to that first scene where he goes off on his philosophy on the Empire and his philosophy on life. So that,
yeah, and he says like, scene. When he can't sleep, he writes, and he said he wrote about Cassian.
Okay.
Like, not you specifically, but I wrote a lot about you. So he's thinking about Cassian, that kind of person with his manifesto, someone who's not completely bought the ideology. And so he thinks this is the person that this book is for, or manifesto.
So I'm curious what Cassian's going to do with it. Well, I mean, what do you do with a manifesto? Has there ever been a scenario where a manifesto was a positive thing and not just rantings of a madman? I mean, the only time I ever hear the word manifesto is when you're talking about a serial killer that the cops catch, you know? There's no positive connotation for a manifesto.
I mean,
I think they're referring to like the Communist Manifesto, or
But even that is
okay.
That's kind of the raisings of a crazy person.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not meant to be like some inspiring piece of literature, right? Everyone kind of makes fun of Nemec throughout the whole thing.
Oh no, I'm totally calling. They're going to use Nemec's manifesto as like the groundwork for the philosophy of the rebellion. Like,
no,
that's how it's going to...
Are you serious?
Yep. I'm totally calling that.
God, I hate it. You're probably right.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know.
I guess we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
All right, so we're getting close to the end here. The one note I had is where is Cinta during all of this? The last time we saw her, she was with J-Hold's wife and kid. Clearly, Clem has taken off on the freighter, so they are that got the heck out of Dodge. Like, how does Cinta get out of there? There's not really anyone left except her.
They show her like walking out into the field, I think, towards with like the soldier uniform, like basically like, all right, she's on her own now. And like Vel like said goodbye to her at that one point where she had to stay behind and watch that family. So I think that was kind of part of the plan. And that was one of the reasons Vel was so hesitant and, all of that stuff. So,
well, there's like three rapid fire scenes left. So let's just power through them. It cuts briefly to the Imperial Security Bureau again. And I don't know what time at night it is, but it's all hands on deck. So the Imperial Security Bureau meeting we saw last time maybe had 20 people. In that room, I think there's probably 50 people now. And the main guy, his line was, no one is going home. I want every star sector and planetary emergency retaliation plan in the building ready for presentation by midnight. So clearly this heist has gotten back to the larger Empire, probably because it was a large amount of money. And all the resources are going to be thrown at this problem. So that's a super quick scene. Mm-hmm. The next scene cuts to Senator Mon Mothma, and she is at the Galactic Senate, and she is giving a speech about, I don't even know, something kind of boring. but she's looking out, like it wasn't related to the plot, I should say. It was just general bureaucratic stuff. And it looks out on, the rest of the Galactic Senate, and you see that there are like several empty pods. I would say 50% of the pods are empty, and the remaining pods are, they have senators from other planets or whatever in them, and several of them are talking. Like, I'm like, oh, this is kind of rude. Are they just being disrespectful to Mon Mothma? Does she not have a good reputation in the Senate? And then you realize they're all looking at their iPads, and essentially what happens is news of this heist lands on the news, or probably hits, emergency alert on everybody's iPad. And so essentially all these senators basically just get up and walk out because this is, whatever, this is the 9/11 of their time. Like, this is going to be a big deal. So they all, so the Galactic Senate essentially wraps up for the day, and the final scene cuts to Luthen's shop. Doug, I feel like this would be a good scene. Do you want to describe the last scene in Luthen's shop?
I feel like really put on the spot at the moment, but let me try. Okay. So there's like some random customer in there looking at some jewelry or something. And he comes up and says something about like, there's an inscription on this that can mean whatever you want it to mean.
It's in a lost language so that you can interpret it however you want.
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. And then someone else was like, do you have anything from whatever the name of that planet
said,
was?
Yeah, there was
Hold on,
there's a patron or a customer sitting in the corner of the shop, and it kind of looked like he was reading the newspaper, or maybe he's reading his iPad or whatever. And out of nowhere, he says, yeah, do you have anything from Aldani? And it catches Luthen off guard, like, wait, what? And then he basically says, oh, yeah, there was a massive, you know, breach or whatever there last night. It's just on all of the news. Now, was I the only one? I had to look it up. I thought that that guy that was in the shop, I thought that was Cyril. But it's not. It's not the same actor. It's just, as far as I can tell, it's just a random guy.
Correct, yeah, it's a random guy.
Okay, I thought the episode was going to wrap with Cyril figured it out and he traced the heist back to Luthen and they were going to arrest Luthen, then it was going to be Starwipe. But that's not what happens.
Right, yeah.
Oh, that would have been interesting.
I don't think we see Cyril Karn at all in this episode, right?
Not in this episode, no.
It was unusual, but...
So this episode ends with Luthen getting caught off guard by this request for Aldani artifacts. He says, I don't know, let me go check in the back, and he walks in the back, and then he has, like, that evil villain maniacal laughter to himself in the back. And I assume at that point that it was... I mean, he has to already know the status of the mission, right? I mean, he was probably refreshing the news all night. It wasn't like he waited for this patron to come in and tell him. So I think, is that just like the first time he lets his guard down and he relaxes? Like, hey, it actually
I think
worked?
It was breaking.
Why was he laughing? Yeah, why did he break?
No, I think it was breaking news. I think this is the first time he heard about it. And he knows now if it's news, it's a successful mission. Like, this is a big deal. I mean, he put the pieces together pretty quickly. I think, you know, he got off his police scanner, maybe, and was relaxing a little bit. And then, yeah, this happened.
I just kind of assumed he would have been on that police scanner, like, all night, right?
Well, that's how they showed him in the last episode, right?
Yeah, but, I mean, he's now at work, and he can't just listen to that all the time on his earpods. But anyway.
That was going to be my next question. So when he's working in this shop, is that the real Luthen? Is that his real job? Or is the real job a cover for him that he just uses to meet up with Mon Mothma?
I get the impression that he's done this job for a long time, and he's developed like a relationship. It's whether or not it's the real him. I mean, he obviously had to put a disguise on to be this person. So not really, but... Yeah, it's I guess yet to be seen, but it feels like this is something he's been doing a long time, developing relationships, developing a reputation.
Well, that's it. I mean, so it basically star wipes after Luthen goes back in the shop and has his little maniacal laughter, and so that's it. I mean, the heist was a success. We had a couple losses or a couple deaths. Nemec died, Skeen was killed, and Terramin died, right?
Yeah, basically everyone is. I mean, the whole team, almost the whole team, got wiped out.
Yeah,
it was, yeah, brutal. Like, Vel is left. Vel, to me, I think, you know, maybe her leadership skills are questionable, but I think she proved herself to be the actual true believer in someone that is. You know, she's gonna die for the cause. She'll sacrifice everything. She's going to be the trustworthy one to, like, bring that score back.
Where is Gorn at this point? Is he still back in the garrison?
Yeah, yeah.
I was curious about that. I mean, he's kind of dead now, isn't he?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe. Probably.
Yeah, he...
I mean, they didn't explicitly show it in this episode, but if he didn't escape, they're going to torture for him for information,
for sure.
And he's going to die.
Yeah, for sure, so...
Yeah, that was kind of a loose end, I think. I mean, there was one little quote where the big colonel guy says, like, oh, you'll hang for this. And he says, oh, serving you 7 years, I deserve worse, or something like that. So he kind of understood, like,
he basically implies, I've done horrible, horrible things for you. I deserve way worse than hanging. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're past the hour mark here, so let's go with ratings. Do you want to start us off, Doug? Okay.
I liked the quick pacing of this episode. The visuals in it were definitely, I mean, there was at least a couple that were just breathtaking, like just amazing. So definitely a strong episode, stronger than last week. I'm going to give this one a 9 out of 10.
Jason, do you agree?
Yeah. I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10, baby. 10 out of 10, baby. This might be one of the best, like, series of episodes I've ever seen, especially in Star Wars, at least in Star Wars. One of the best episodes, one of the best scenes of him escaping on that freighter with the TIE fighters and this like crystal meteor shower. I mean, this was rocking. And I feel lucky. I mean, we don't even know, again, after these three episodes, we don't know what's going to happen next. All these, this previous set pieces and characters, they're gone, baby. And we're going somewhere new.
I'm with you.
Cassian isn't even going to the Rebels. Like, he's off on his own now.
Yep.
I mean, it feels so awesome.
We're right in the middle of the season, so this is the end of episode 6. There are 6 more. But yeah, I don't know where it's going to go. So we'll see.
Enjoying these three episode arcs, too.
It's like, a cool piece of storytelling, yeah.
Did we get a number?
I was just going to say, no, I agree with Jason. I think this is about as close to a flawless piece of television as you can get. I mean, the storytelling is great. The effects were great. The characters were great. The action was good. The tension was good. I mean, it was just great start to finish. So, yeah, 10 out of 10 for me. I would watch television like this any day of the week. And I will do you one better. I will even go so far as to say, after watching this episode, I now believe that Dan Gilroy is the best of the Gilroys.
Oh, okay. We'll have to discuss that more. I definitely agree with you. This is one of the best pieces of Star Wars cinema that I've seen, except for Bell.
Dan Gilroy, if you're out there and listening, shoot us a message. You can come on our podcast and talk about how great you are.
And maybe explain why with Fel.
You're not accountable for that. All right, it's getting late. Jason, you want to sign us off?
Yeah, Logic Gate out.